Welcome to On Air with the Mountain Lion Foundation, broadcasting research and policy discussions to understand the issues that face the American lion.
Hello, my name is Julie West with the Mountain Lion Foundation. I look forward to speaking with today's guest, Steve Pavlik. Steve teaches Native American Studies and Native Science at Northwest Indian College in Bellingham, Washington, and has over 30 years of experience in American Indian education. He holds master's degrees in both American Indian Studies and in American History from the University of Arizona. Mr. Pavlik is the author of an upcoming book, The Navajos and the Animal People, Essays in American Indian Ethnozoology, and he's edited two other books, A Good Cherokee, A Good Anthropologist, Essays in Honor of Robert K. Thomas, and Destroying Dogma, Find Deloria Jr. and His Influence on American Society. He has also published over 60 other articles, essays, and reviews, including chapters and anthologies on mountain lions and on Mexican wolves. He has lectured and presented extensively in the field of Native American studies. His areas of academic specialization include Native American religion and spirituality, ethnozoology, cognitive ethology, and environmental ethics. Mr. Pavlik is a naturalist and activist who has volunteered with numerous environmental organizations, including Defenders of Wildlife, the Sierra Club, and the Sky Island Alliance. His special interest is large carnivore conservation, and he has been especially active in campaigning for the reform of wildlife management policy as it relates to carnivores. So welcome, Steve. Hello.
Great talking to you, Julie, and thank you for inviting me today.
Yes, and I'm really intrigued to speak with you for a number of reasons, but some of my other guests have been wildlife scientists or maybe have come from a wildlife management background, and so I look forward to speaking with you because you bring the academic scholarly perspective and also the Native American perspective, which I think will shed light in a unique way on the subject of mountain lion ecology. So as a place of starting, now your bio mentions that you're engaged in cognitive ethology, and that's a new term for me, and so I loved learning a little bit about it, that it's the study of the emotional and behavioral lives of animals. So I thought you could start by telling us about this area of academic specialization in your studies.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I guess, you know, in a nutshell, you know, people who consider themselves to be cognitive ethologists basically believe that animals are individuals, that they possess rational thought, that they possess rational conscious thought, including self-consciousness, that they're sort of blessed with a rich range of emotions, very similar to what you or I might possess. I think that, you know, I can't speak for all people who identify themselves as being cognitive ethologists, but, you know, for me, you know, I think wildlife management talks too much, particularly when it comes to carnivores, about instinct. You know, and, you know, the topic of today, of course, is mountain lions, that, you know, mountain lions are unpredictable, that mountain lions act strictly on instinct. And so, consequently, you know, you treat them as if in that respect. Whereas somebody from my perspective, you know, you consider mountain lions to be thinking, well, from a Native American standpoint, certainly thinking beings, just like you or myself.
Yes, interesting. And you had also mentioned that this is kind of a brave new world, and I don't know, you know, how long ago that statement was made, but is that true? Is cognitive ethology a relatively new branch of animal behavior science?
You know, it really is. I shouldn't say its origins are old. I mean, if you go back in time in the 1870s, no less a scientist than Charles Darwin wrote a book on animal emotions, and and so on, and he described emotional views of animals in this book. But then for the next 100 years or so, you know, the field sort of languished and nobody was really doing much of anything. And then finally, you know, we have a few scholars who popped up like Donald Griffin and Mark Beekhoff and some others who in recent years have been really doing a lot of writing in that field. Oftentimes the research in cognitive ethology deals with domesticated animals, or sometimes it deals with the so-called higher animals like whales and dolphins and primates. My interest, though, is, you know, carnivores.
Do you think that an orientation toward cognitive ethology, especially as it might become part of the mainstream dialogue, could potentially begin to influence policy and some of the wildlife management practice with that as the backbone?
I definitely believe it can. And sort of, well, jumping a little bit ahead, I teach at Northwest Indian College, as you mentioned, and we're a tribal college up in Washington State. Our student body is almost totally Native American, and we have the country's only 4-year Bachelor of Science degree in Native environmental education. And it's our goal, you know, to produce tribal wildlife managers who perhaps see things differently than mainstream wildlife managers. And in fact, right now, I've developed a class which I plan on teaching in the fall on indigenous cognitive ethology. Because I think that, you know, Native Americans have always been cognitive ethologists. They've always believed that animals can think, that animals are conscious, that animals have emotions. So, you know, it has to begin somewhere, and I'm hoping it'll begin with the Native American tribes in this country.
Yes, and hopefully those voices can become part of the dominant culture's way of viewing animals as well. Well, this
I really
might
hope
be
so.
An interesting segue then. In many indigenous ancestral stories, the boundaries between the human and non-human worlds, which include animals, is often blurred. And I've been fascinated by tales of transformation or shape-shifting, where a man might marry a woman who's really a bear or a mountain lion, for example, and then spend part of the year with her animal family. And I love these stories. I see them as stewarding strategies. Because if you're related, you presumably won't exterminate a species, but you'll safeguard its survival. So I thought you could speak to some of these perspectives as they're understood in your work with Native American communities.
Well, you know, you're correct about Native American thought versus, you know, Western thought. If you look at you know, mainstream society's Judeo-Christian background, you know, the Christian creation story, so to speak, tells us that man was created first, that man was created in God's image, that animals came to be created later on, that man was given the power to name animals, he was given dominion over animals. And so consequently, I think, you know, most people in Western society have just been brought up with that attitude that, you know, it's a separate creation, it's just two different, there's us and sort of them. Whereas in Native American culture, you know, if you look at many of the creation stories, man really wasn't created first. It was the animals who came before man. And then man sort of came, this is not true with all tribes, but with most tribes that I'm familiar with, you know, man was created later on. And consequently, there was no ideas of dominion over the animals. And in fact, you know, most tribes, you know, talk of a time when man and animals and even the deities could walk together, talk together, they lived and they communicated with each other. And so there was, you know, you used the word blurring, and I think that's probably as good a term as any, but I would say that there was a very thin line between humans and the animal world. And the thinner that line is, the easier that line, I think, is to cross. And so, yeah, in many of these stories, you know, animals had that power of transformation. In many of the Native stories, you know, you have accounts of humans marrying animals and so on, and and back and forth, and children who were part animal and part human. And so, yeah, you know, I think that, you know, in that way of thinking of things, if you it, there's a big difference between looking at a mountain lion and seeing him as just simply an animal, perhaps a resource, or more likely a problem or a nuisance, as opposed to looking at a mountain lion and seeing him as a relative. And I think,
Nice
you know,
way of putting it. Yes,
that's a
we're
big
all
distinction.
related. Well, then how do you, I wonder how people can hold that thought as they are concerned about coexisting with animals such as predators like cougars. I know that cougars are elusive creatures who, you know, aren't likely to strike out at a human or kill a human, but there does seem to be this fear that really triggers people. How can we coexist with large predators?
Well, you know, I think part of dealing with any other being, whether it's a human or whether it's one of the of you know what Navajos would refer to as being the animal people, I mean, I think any relationship has to begin with respect. And I, in the past, we just simply haven't shown that much respect to animals like lions and particularly carnivores and predators. We teach our children to fear them. You know, I was thinking, oh, I don't know, when I was a kid growing up, I used to watch Wild Kingdom and different animal programs on TV, and you know, I just watched them constantly. But today, when you turn on the television, you know, you're watching programs on whether it's the Animal Planet, Discovery Channel, or whatever, and they tend to be more, you know, sort of like it's like animal programming on TV has entered into a phase of reality TV or their version of reality. And so
I've
you're
noticed
most
that.
likely to see something called animal when animals attack or when animals go wild or the top 10 animal attacks or something like that. And I think it's just really up to us to teach our children that there's a different side of these animals and it begins with respecting them.
And also, in so many instances, people are encroaching on wildlife habitat. They're choosing to live in these pristine, beautiful areas where their home is maybe right where animals need to access the waterways or large tracts of land. And so it's no surprise when predators wander through your property. Again, how can people practically coexist if they're choosing to live in these places where there are likely to be animals?
Well, you know, that's another thing. You know, we hear from pretty much every game and fish department that, you know, mountain lion populations are exploding all over the country. And so it's like, you know, everywhere you look, there's mountain lions. And I guess I'm one of the people who believe that if anything, mountain lion populations are probably in decline in this country. I think you're probably seeing more lions because, you know, their habitat is shrinking and we are pushing them out of their territory, and we're forcing them to come down into our towns. And then the other thing, of course, is, you know, we create our towns as gardens where deer come in and feed and so on. And of course, the mountain lion follows the game. And, you know, I think back to a Navajo view of things, you know, Navajos say that when you see an animal that is sort of out of place, or he's in a place or a location where you normally do not see him, then what is happening is that animal is trying to reach out to you. That animal is trying to send you a message. And I think these lions that are coming into urban areas are trying to send us a message. And that message is that we have to stop, you know, destroying their habitat and stop pushing them out of their habitat. So I think it's time we listen to the animals who are trying to speak to us.
And you've written about the jaguar too, haven't you? And its historic range in the Americas,
Yes.
especially the recent case concerning Macho Bee, the jaguar who was killed. Maybe you
Right.
can speak to that.
Well, you know, I think, well, but it does point out another, okay, for your audience who may not be familiar with the story, The Southwest has historically been home. The American Southwest has historically been home to jaguars for forever. And in recent years, like so many other animals, we've hunted them, we've pushed them out of range, and there's only a handful of jaguars left in the entire American Southwest. And a number of years ago, they photographed a jaguar, who they then went on to call Macho B. And this jaguar, for a period of almost 12 years, was photographed with remote cameras in a particular mountain range in southeastern Arizona. But the entire time, Arizona Game and Fish Department was bent on capturing this animal, putting a radio collar on him, and tracking him, even when he became an elderly cat. And to make a long story short, because it is a long story, eventually they did catch him, and they put him, they injected him with drugs to put him asleep, and then they put a collar on his neck, and he wandered off up into a rock ledge, and he never really moved again. They had to come in a week later because he was so weak, and at that point they could just basically pick him up and bring him in, and they wound up euthanizing him. And I
Oh.
think, it was a tragic story that angered a lot of people because it was a classic example of mismanagement of wildlife in this country. And it sort of also goes into what we're talking about today. From a Native American perspective, you don't have to put a radio collar on that animal and track him and learn every nuance of his life. That jaguar was out there. He was out there for perhaps 16, 18, perhaps 20 years. And, he was a mystery to people, but there are some mysteries that we're not meant to know. There's some
Right.
mysteries that we're not entitled to know. But Western society, has an attitude that's contrary to that. And so we wound up killing this magnificent animal who might very well be, the last jaguar in the American Southwest. And
Yeah.
when you figure that we're putting up the border fence between the United States and Mexico, which would preclude any other future jaguar from coming up from Mexico, those are the things that we bring upon ourselves.
Right, and I know coloring is such a hard one even for me. I get on the one hand that the collars are giving you vital information about their migratory routes and maybe that you could then use that information to better advise game and fish departments or even transportation, how we think about our infrastructure and where we make our bridges and highways. But on the other hand, as you say, they're doing
Well,
just fine out there.
it's a scientific tool, but you really wonder how much can you learn from a population of one animal.
Well, now you've worked with some other cougar biologists. I know Harley Shaw is one cougar biologist you've worked with. Maybe you could just talk about some of the things you did with Dr. Shaw and anyone else you want to group in that category.
Well, yeah, I've known Harley for many years now, and in addition to the work I do, with tribes and on Native American aspect of mountain lion conservation, I also, I'm certainly not a scientist. If anything, I guess I would classify myself as a naturalist in that area. But many years ago, Harley got a mountain lion study going in the Huachuca Mountains in southeastern Arizona. And it was a study which was a very, it didn't have, it was basically a track count survey. And for almost, I think, and I may be wrong on the dates, but I think for almost a 20-year period, Harley and the people who followed after Harley ran these track counts in Huachuca Mountains for this period of time, recorded where the mountain lions were and so on. And that's how I got to meet Harley. I worked on that track count for many years myself. So
So
I've
what were
worked with other
you?
people.
So you were just tracking them, and that's maybe a different way of understanding their range instead of collaring them to actually track
Right,
them the
it's
old-fashioned way.
and I think increasingly, people are starting to move towards less intrusive means of studying wildlife. That idea of radio collaring and so on and so forth. You can only I think we've pretty much learned all we can learn about basic mountain lion behavior through radio collars and tracking and so on and so forth. And I think, you know, it's just a matter of keeping track of animals, keeping track of these animals when they come into urban areas and so on. I think those are the things we need to know.
Mm-hmm. And I know you have been critical of Arizona Game and Fish. It does seem like Game and Fish departments are often in the front line position to, as first responders, to orchestrate the strategies that will ultimately affect that lion's future. And I wonder if you could talk about some of the more successful strategies you know of, maybe translocation, for example, of an animal. There might be other examples, and maybe some of the worst case examples as well.
Well, I think, you know, Game and Fish, you know, I know a lot of people within various Game and Fish departments, and I think, you know, the vast majority of people who I've met and worked with are certainly good people. I mean, they don't get into wildlife management because they you know, hate animals or something like that. And in many cases, you know, I think they are limited to some of the things that they do. I know in Arizona Game and Fish, for example, one animal that I've done research on for many of years, I've done a lot of black bear research over the years. And there was a case back in the 1980s, I believe, where there was a young woman who was mauled by a black bear up in the Catalina Mountains in Arizona. And she sued Arizona Game and Fish for $2.5 million and got it and received that money. And from that moment on, there was a marked difference in the way Game and Fish dealt with moving animals from one place to another. My work with bears showed that up until that event, 80% of the quote-unquote problem bears that they trapped, they relocated elsewhere. After that event, 80% of the problem bears, they euthanized. You know, and you could see that sharp line when they changed their policy. And I think that game and fish departments are very reluctant, very scared of being sued by the public. And that's a very real concern. And so I think a lot of times, I think, for example, they exaggerate the dangers of mountain lions and bears just to keep the distance between mountain lions and bears and humans. And I think that's sort of unfortunate. But you know, at the end of the day, though, you know, game and fish departments primarily, you know, sort of serve two masters. The one are the landowners, and the second ones are the hunters. And they want to keep the landowners happy so they can keep the land open for hunting, and that's where they get their money from. And so, you know, I think, you know, animals like mountain lions, the predators, are sort of up against a stacked deck. They're viewed as being competitors and viewed as being public dangers and so on. And so we tend to manage carnivores very badly.
Seems like we need those creation stories to be part of our collective thinking again, but it seems like that's a slow transition.
It is.
A friend had told me about visiting Indonesia, and one of the parks in Indonesia was closed on certain days of the week, presumably because the monkey gods would be angered if you came into the park. And I love thinking on that as a national park strategy to give the land a break, to give the creatures in the park a break by, again, reviving or putting the myth story out there. It's folkloric, yet it's practical because, the park gets a break.
Well, I think those are the things that we really need to do. I think one of the things that we also need to move to, and I don't think that the political winds in this country are favorable, especially now towards that, is granting legal rights to the natural world. You know, unfortunately, you can move into an area and poison the water and clear cut the forest and fence up an entire area for cattle or whatever the case may be. And the animals that are in there just simply, they have to move on or become exterminated.
Right. They're a byproduct of that larger process.
And that's one of the things I like to do in working with tribes, because if there were any people on this continent who one would hope would be most receptive to the idea of, and what I'm really talking about here, is constitutionally guaranteeing rights for the natural world and the wildlife, it would be the tribes to whom it was always a natural part of their heritage.
Is that, can you give a hint then of your upcoming book, The Navajos and the Animal People, Essays in American Indian Ethnozoology, and maybe tell us something that might we can look forward to in reading this book?
Sure. The book started out actually, it was a product many years actually in the making. One of my professors at University of Arizona was the famous Sioux scholar Vine Deloria Jr. And Vine one time invited me to sit on a panel on Native American religion at a conference that we were attending. And I told him, I said, Vine, I said, at the time, I said, I really don't know that much about religion. He said, well, he says, you know about Navajos, you know about animals, so why don't you do a presentation on Navajos and animals? So, okay. So I wound up presenting a paper on a Navajo relationship to bears. And that was very well received. And so the next year, on that same panel, I wound up doing a paper, I think, on Navajos and wolves. And then the next year it was coyotes, and the next year it was jaguars, and the next year it was snakes, and the next year it was... And so over a period of time, I wound up presenting like about 10 of these papers. And I don't know if I did this consciously, but I realized that all these animals that I'd been writing on were predators, carnivores. So at any rate, people have been talking to me over the years about cleaning up these articles, putting them together, and coming up with a book. And so that's kind of the genesis of the book. There's a chapter in there on bears, one on mountain lions, one on wolves, coyotes, jaguars, snakes, eagles, and another concluding chapter on smaller predators as well. So,
talk about the chapter on mountain lions a little bit. Do you get into some of the actual Navajo ceremonies that are related to the mountain lion, the sacred cat?
Yes. Yes, ceremonialism is obviously a part of that. So much to tell, but, in the beginning when people emerged, mountain lion was one of the original deities that were there. And, so there was a mountain lion, sort of, in capital letters, capital M, capital L, who was very much like, the Navajos would be. I would be tempted to say that Navajos viewed mountain lions and bears and other animals anthropomorphically, but at the same time, that's sort of a human way of looking at things. In other words, at the beginning, all the beings sort of had a shape. And a lot of times when Navajos view or tell these stories, or when they imagine these animals in another time, in the creation stories, in the time before time, so to speak, they're in the shape of human beings. And mountain lion in the early stories is one of the most important of the Navajo deities. He's one of the leaders of the Navajos, of all the animal people. He was always been admired because of his strength and his courage and his stealth and his speed and his intelligence and so on. And so Navajo, mountain lion at the very beginning was seen as being one of the important deities. Later on, as the Navajo stories go on, and as the Navajos came to be as a people, mountain lion was also assigned to be a protector for one of the major Navajo clans. And this role, mountain lion sort of protected the people against enemies and so on. And there's a story of how the Navajos were attacked at one point by an enemy, which, you know, some anthropologists believe were probably the Ute Indians. And after the Navajos had been beaten up very badly by the Utes, you know, then they asked the mountain lion's help, and he attacked the Utes and tore them up and protected his people. And then at that point, you know, there was concern that now that mountain lion had tasted human blood, so to speak, that could we ever fully trust him again? And so at that point, he was told that he needed to live apart from the people, and he went up into the mountains, and he became the mountain lion as we know today. So that was kind of the origin of mountain lions.
Well, have you seen a mountain lion or had any experiences with mountain lions that you'd like to share?
You know, I'm one of those people who have really not been blessed with seeing a mountain lion in the wild. You know, I've done a lot of mountain lion tracking over the years, and there's been literally times when I've gone up a trail, you know, which, you know, fresh snow on it, you know, gone up to the top of the mountain, started back down the trail and found mountain lion tracks on top of my tracks.
Oh,
you know, because mountain lions are sort of, they're cats. They're very curious. And they do like following people. They do like observing people. And I think there's probably a lot that you could say about that. You know, they mean you no harm, no malice, but they're just sort of curious. And
yeah.
So that's always a wonderful experience when you know that you have one of these animals who's out there following you around.
Well, we need to close soon, and this is maybe closing on a broad note, but I watched a lecture by your friend and colleague, Dan Wildcat, Power and Place, Indian Education in America. And he talks about the difference, and he admits this is a very crude distinction between Western philosophy and indigenous philosophy. Western philosophy having more of an obsession to organize the world into categories and break things down into discrete areas, and indigenous philosophy really having to do with observing relationships and processes that humans are just in the middle of and living in the world. So it's more relational oriented. And I have noticed a trend, at least in academia, towards interdisciplinary studies where boundaries between disciplines might be blurred in favor of learning something outside your area of expertise. And so in that regard, I don't know if this is a temporary trend or if this is a slow cycle, long slow cycle back to some of the indigenous thinking that's guided humans for so long on the planet. And just wondered if you had any thoughts on that, or if you see that trend as hopeful, or if you notice it yourself.
Well, several things come to mind. I think that when you look at what we humans are doing to the planet, whether it's poisoning the air, poisoning the water, clear-cutting the forest, or driving species of animals into extinction, I mean, it's obvious that we have to change. You know, we have to look at nature in a different way. And I think, you know, part of it goes back to, and this is one of the things that certainly, you know, Dan talked about it in that lecture that you heard, you know, the idea that, you know, where you see yourself in comparison with the rest of the natural world. You know, people like to say, for example, when talking about Indians, they sort of talk about Indians as almost in a romantic sort of way. They say that Indians worship nature, they love nature, we're close to nature, or something like that. But in reality, the best way to look at it, that Indians were a part of the natural world. They were an integral and intimate part of the natural world. And it was all about relationships. You know, ecology is a relatively new field for Western society, but Native people have been ecologists since the beginning of time. And that idea of having a relationship with the natural world, it has to be a relationship where you where you not only take, which we as Western people are very good at doing, but it has to be a relationship in which we give back as well. You know, the Native American relationship with the rest of the earth was reciprocal. You know, you played a part in it. You perhaps hunted a deer. You took a deer's life for food. But at the same time, you offered the right prayers and the right ceremonies. One of the things you talked about a moment ago, in the case of Indonesia, you know, there were times when tribes would go into the mountains and just pray for the well-being of that mountain, for the health and the well-being of that mountain and all the animals that were there. And so there was, and I think of the Lakotas and the Black Hills, they set aside the month of June as a time when they took care of the mountain. They helped the mountain heal. And we don't look at things that way. We just continue to take. Our relationship to the natural world is not an appropriate relationship in that respect. And whereas the Native relationship to the natural world was appropriate, it was reciprocal, it was appropriate, and you know, you have to do those things.
Yeah, and I wonder if we'll get back to that maybe by dire consequence because we have to, or I'll be curious to know, because I am a glass half full person, you know, what will be the markers in our path that will lead us back to that place of reverence and respect and reciprocity. And surely your work as an educator is one of those markers, and other colleagues of yours and folks, the Mountain Lion Foundation being another one.
Yeah.
So thank you for the work you do, Steve, and thank you for the interview today.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes. All right.
Enjoyed it.
This has been a Mountain Lion Foundation On Air broadcast. On Air is a copyrighted production of the Mountain Lion Foundation. Permission to rebroadcast is granted for non-commercial use. For more information, visit mountainlion.org.